How do you spot burnout coming? I don't think you can. And that's kind of the, like, I wish you could. I really do. I think empathy is important for others and for yourself, because ultimately, others can help, but you alone are the only one who can help you get out of or work through the burnout. Like, to not work through it, survive it.
Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey, everyone. Our guest today is Daniel Stockman. Daniel, since like 2018-ish, you've been the primary maintainer of Lerna. I know you even started contributing to it a little bit before that.
Yeah. About 2016, I started contributing. 2017 or so, I became the maintainer.
Gotcha. It's a long legendary run, which has recently come to a close, as all good things do. And I'm excited to dig into this a little bit. But before we get into the story of Lerna and your contributions there, would you like to tell our guests any more about yourself, or our audience, should I say?
Yeah. It's funny, I just started a new job this week, so I've been doing this a lot this week. I'm Daniel. I am the now former maintainer of Lerna. I was not the author, I'll mind you. It's an unfortunate thing that no, it's not unfortunate. People say, yay, thanks for making Lerna. I'm like, yeah, I did, but I didn't. I came to it after it had gone to a V2 already. But in many ways, I did help make it what it is today. I'm a front-end dev by trade. I worked for a long time at Zillow. I now work at Convoy, two great Seattle-based startups. Well, they were startups when I joined. Zillow is a much bigger company now. I really enjoy the front-end. I like writing CLIs. I like Node.js. I like karaoke. That's me. Oh, and also, of course, podcast viewers can't see this in the background, but I also like to collect whiskey. I've got lots of bottles of single malt scotch behind me, empty from several years of collecting. But yes.
Nice. I can relate to you on most of those points, except the karaoke one.
I will submit that you just haven't found the right place yet.
Maybe. Hopefully it's not just me. Okay, so let's start off with talking about what experience did you have in open source before getting into Lerna, or was Lerna your first real foray into it?
I mentioned Node.js. I've been involved in various communities in open source since probably around 2011 or so. First off, it was like this front-end framework called YUI, or the Yahoo User Interface Framework. It's OG. They were really interesting because at the time, corporations really didn't know what to do with open source. And Yahoo was one of the pioneers, really, of integrating into GitHub and all that. And it was really cool. I mean, I got to know a bunch of the contributors, which were all pretty much Yahoo employees. But so since then, it's been like, on the front end, we have increasingly been using NPM for everything. And pretty much NPM lives all on GitHub, for the source, that is. And yeah, so like I wrote a few random things. I have mostly CLI-based stuff, a couple of tools that I was using at Zillow at the time. And then, Lerna was by far the biggest thing I've ever been involved in directly on GitHub. Or in open source generally. So I guess I could say I had experience in open source before getting involved with Lerna, but it was a completely different nature. Like I was contributing small patches to small projects or releasing my own small, used by basically nobody projects. That's pretty much where I was at the start.
So maybe we can dig into the start of the journey. Like, how did you stumble across Lerna? How did you get involved? What was the sort of story there?
Yeah. So a lot of things around Lerna really do connect to where I was working at the time, which is Zillow. And so Zillow was big in, I mean, they build a website, so obviously they're big in the front end. We had started using React in 2015, or at least I had started using React in 2015. And very quickly, we found that we wanted to basically build, we had many product teams at Zillow, and we wanted to collaborate on one central big umbrella project. And so we started exploring, well, how do we do that? And I was like, I think we should use NPM packages because they're pretty cool and they're easy to like share and manage versions and this, that, and the other thing. Around that same time, because it quickly became a question of, well, okay, yeah, NPM packages, but then how do we do this? How do we organize this? And it was like a billion different repos with one pet. No, that's not going to work. So I started exploring this newfangled thing called monorepos. And I guess just to clarify, when I say monorepo, I generally mean a collection of NPM packages all in one repository, which is contrasting with the traditional pattern of one package per repo. There is a different concept of monorepo, which is like the way that, say, a Google or a Facebook might consider a monorepo being a monolithic repository, like the only one they use with the, you know, huge tree of nightmarish proportions that you usually only ever work on one small subslice, and they have lots of dedicated tooling. Well, I'm talking about the more smaller, in some cases, but smaller scope in any case, concept of a single repository for lots of NPM packages. Generally, a single, and yeah, so that's where I've kind of got into Lerna. And funnily enough, I found Lerna, I mean, because it had been announced basically like the summer. So, sorry, I got into it the fall of 2016, I want to say. They had just released it that summer, like live on stage. Like I think Sebastian did like a, you know, git commit push or whatever on stage, or NPM publish or whatever. So that was the extraction, the initial version. I got to it when it was already V2-ish. Funnily enough, I also got to it when it had suffered its first minor fork it was called Assini, which is a really deep cut because it's the name of a town in Greece that's like near Lerna, the Lernaean Hydra being the source of this. Greek places. The fork eventually got merged back in. It was a misunderstanding. Things happen. But I was involved with Assini, and as a result of that merge, I became part of Lerna. And so it was pretty cool. I mean, I immediately was like, yeah, this is pretty cool. This could solve our problems really well at Zillow. And just kind of kept going. Because it was relatively early in the history, it was still a single code base. It wasn't the giant explosion of packages you see today. so it was, you know, it was pretty tractable. I mean, I got my head around it. It was, you know, It was a slightly different coding style, but you know, hey, that's something you get used to. That's how I got involved, and how I became the sole maintainer is basically, well, over time, folks got busy, or you know, found other things to do, or you know, like happens in open source. I persisted because Zillow was really like we invested in it. It became the backbone of like one of the two biggest pages on Zillow, which is the home details page, like the contrast of like the search, the map where you search for stuff, you find the homes, you click on one of them. That's the home detail page. It integrated like upwards of a dozen different product, you know, different slices of it. The mortgage team, the comparative homes, like a whole bunch of stuff. The price history. And it was really cool. I was lucky enough to have Zillow basically subsidize me and help, you know, me maintain, devote pretty close to, I mean, I for a while in 2017, I was arguably full-time on Lerna. I would not have had enough bandwidth to do as much as I did that year otherwise. But, you know, that's a transient thing, because at a certain point, it's, you know, like feature complete, mostly done. So, I mean, and you kind of, I mean, different job responsibilities start to pull you away. And, you know, that's kind of what happened.
Well, maybe before we go too much further, we should sure. probably start with this. But for those who are listening, you did a great job of like explaining the type of monorepos that Lerna targets. But we haven't really talked about like what Lerna is itself. We've just sort of inferred. But if you had to describe Lerna to someone who was just like hearing about it for the first time, how would you describe it and its responsibilities?
Oh, it's a command line tool for managing multiple NPM packages in a single repository, also known as a monorepo. And that management extends from what we call bootstrapping, which is like installing for all of those packages. We have a script runner, a shell executor, and the most important parts, versioning and publishing. Yeah, that's the elevator pitch, basically.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I see a lot of people get confused about what the different tools do. Lerna was definitely an inspiration for the field, but like even in those threads where people are like, where's the maintainer? Everybody's like, oh, I'm just gonna switch to NX. It's like, well, that's not really the whole picture.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, over time, as a relative newbie maintainer, I will admit to saying yes more than I should have. In terms of like feature requests and stuff like that. And even some of the features that I added, like I now regret. There are certain subcommands that should not be there. and there are luckily some subcommands that have been completely replaced by like built-in package manager functionality. That's really cool. But the one part I think this is, judging by the level of the number of tests that I wrote for this particular area, the versioning and publishing parts are by far the most complicated and still the most, they aren't covered by modern package managers yet. Now, a while back, I was talking to the NPM folks and they were soliciting feedback for their Workspaces implementation. And I told them straight up, you should not devote any effort to versioning in your V1. Like, you should stay far away. It's a fraught minefield. They generally followed my advice. I think they still have plans at some point, but it's not something that, because there's so many different variations and there's existing tools as well as too, like change sets from Atlassian or RushStack. I mean, there are many different approaches to it now. And luckily Lerna still works. I mean, Lerna version of Publish still works. You might get a few angry audit warnings, but it's a command line tool. Like if you're bundling Lerna into production, that would expose it to, you know, supply chain, these attack vectors. I'm like, you have other problems. it's pretty much that. Yeah, like Lerna create, please don't use that. If I just might say, like, don't use Lerna create. It was a terrible idea of mine. And it was only useful really for internal Zillow stuff. But I never really said that before. Whoops. please don't use it. because it was an issue of separation of concerns. Like that was one of the problems with Lerna Create, is that yes, it worked, but it was such a limited feature that is way outside of the scope of what, I mean, it's not managing packages in monorepo. It's templating a package. That's a kind of a separate, you know, responsibility. I should have left well enough alone and just used one of the many templating engines out there. I can think of like Yeoman. They're out there and they do a way better job than Lerna ever will, because that's not Lerna's job. Yeah. That was the one I keep thinking about. Oh, and luckily Lerna add is completely removed or superseded by modern package manager Workspace. Like you should not really need to use Lerna add unless it I mean, if it floats your boat, cool, but you should probably explore the built-in functionality of Yarn workspaces, NPM workspaces, PMPM workspaces. PMPM is super cool. I like PMPM a lot. When I was the maintainer, I didn't say no enough. And it's very hard to say no, respectfully. I mean, like, yeah. Not like I'm, you know, vicious about it, but I'm just, you know, like recognizing my limitations as an individual, maintaining a very complicated project. Every additional option is just like, it's not a linear increase in complexity. It's like a geometric. It's like, it's. And for a single maintainer, I could have done very much better at, you know, being circumspect about the options and things that I accepted. But that's what, you know, is what it is. You learn, you live and learn. I'm happy that it, you know, was around and, you know, able to facilitate so much growth. Certainly, I am really glad that, you know, tools like NX and Turbo Repo and the various package manager implementations have matured so much. Like, my dream is that one day we won't need Lerna anymore. I mean, luckily, with the, you know, Narwhal's announcement, we'll still have a vibrant Lerna to use in the future. I've always held that hope that the package managers would, you know, eventually take the majority, the lion's share of it, and the remainder would probably be, you know, special purpose one-off tools, really. I mean, if you really want Lerna Create, well, here's a single use CLI for that, you know, that sort of thing.
I think it's a part of code that we miss sometimes, but it's actually an important milestone. It's when the code you write is no longer necessary because the ecosystem around it has matured enough that you don't need it. That's actually a great place to be. And I think as an open source maintainer, that's the ideal outcome because, yeah, you know, totally. Like entropy totally exists and maintaining things takes energy and you can't do it forever.
Like, just imagine, I mean, jQuery, for example, several of the APIs of jQuery became part of the web standard. Yep. And that was great because there's so much more energy available to maintain browsers because they're actual companies and things. Whereas the folks behind jQuery, as brilliant as they are, just are people. They're only individuals. That was the ideal case for jQuery, which coincidentally, jQuery is still by far the biggest NPM package, you know, deployed across websites, you know, worldwide, which is funny when you think about it. It's like, yeah. we get fixated on like Vue or React or Angular, but the reality is they're not the majority. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I like that comparison. Cause like Lerna really like set the stage. It's like, here, we solved the base set of problems and it then exposed all these other problems. It was like, we got the idea in people's heads and then they just ran with it. Like when I was starting out using Lerna like years and years ago, Lerna Bootstrap was like the hurdle of getting over. But like Lerna Bootstrap was really just saying like, this is the thing that needs to happen in your monorepo install. And then Yarn and all the other tools kind of like went, oh, let's fill the void and like make this a good experience. The same can be said of like Lerna Exec going to like Turbo Repo and Ultra Runner and all those other things. The one place where really I think Lerna still is like the shining example is that publishing process. I don't know if you know, but I also manage a tool called Otto, and Otto is like heavily built on Lerna for our monorepo publishing experience.
Oh, nice.
So like, nice. I literally had people messaging me like going, hey, is Otto going to need to rewrite everything? I'm like, no, it's cool. It's cool. Somebody's going to fork it.
Yeah.
But going back to what you said about like saying no, like that's such a common problem. Like me myself with Otto, I experienced that. Whereas like you're a newbie maintainer and you're like, oh yeah, every feature, it's a cool feature. Yeah. Let's have it. You want to contribute? Sure. But as time goes on, you slowly realize like every time you say yes is more and more complexity. It's more issues down the line. Like just because they contributed the code doesn't mean they're going to maintain that code. It now becomes your responsibility.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I mean, in another way of thinking about it, and it kind of dovetails back to like my actual day job, which is feature development on websites. It's a very rare open source project that has any concept of product management or product vision, or, you know, like a roadmap is cool, but it doesn't, you know, it's not really quite the same thing. And I felt that very acutely over the years at Lerna, where we had a pretty strong idea of what it was. Like the elevator pitch was pretty compact, but within that, it lacked a lot of definition. Early, it lacked enough definition that I could point. Like, so when I was like, I kept saying yes to things because I didn't have a strong rubric to like kind of judge. Is this part of the mission? Is this serving the users? That kind of questioning that could have led me to saying no earlier on. And I guess I'm not saying that every project has to have something like that, but you know, at least some conception of like what the problem space is, what your dependencies are, what your conceptual dependencies are, not literal ones, but like, and the constraints, like, because it's very true that, you know, I mean, okay, in one sense, it's true that software can do anything if you spend enough time to build it, right? But maybe it shouldn't. you know, that's the kind of the angle I kind of come from now is that you know, well-written tools have a very specific use case. Like they are targeted ideally very, very narrowly, like they on a thing. Like I am the best runner of scripts in a monorepo. I mean, it's a little broader than that, but anything beyond that, you have to have, like, I guess the confidence or the strength or the self-care to say no, because it's not going to ultimately help, right? And if anything, I say that was one of the biggest lessons I learned from maintaining Lerna, was that for all the reasons I've been discussing, saying no is important. It's very hard, but it's also important.
We talked about some of the bad stuff so far, but were there some things about the Lerna project that kept you going? What was the good stuff? Like, did you see some cool projects? Like,
oh man, I still get a little tiny buzz when I see a Lerna JSON in some open source project. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. Of course, now it's kind of a company like, oh, you poor thing, why are you still using this? but I don't want that's not to be dismissive at all. I'm just saying there are better options, except maybe for the publishing part. But yeah, that's probably going to change soon, which is the exciting thing. I hope. I have a pretty good guess that it's going to improve for the better. But yeah, so and other parts, honestly, getting to work with so many different people across so many different companies, different, you know, slices of life. Like a contributor comes to your project and, you know, you get to see a different side of somebody or somebody new, you know, it's like, wow, this is so cool. Like, and some of the contributors to Lerna just blew me away. Like I was like a couple of them, I was going to like, hey, can you join the project right now? I don't even need to see the rest of your code. Just please, please. No, they were too busy, but you know, I was really grateful for those opportunities to meet such interesting, you know, helpful, brilliant folks. And I think also meeting a bunch of people in the JavaScript community was another big plus. Right around the time of the licensing debacle, which in many ways, you know, you could probably mark as the beginning of the end of my frequent contributions. But it was also the beginning in many ways of a broader interaction with the JavaScript community, like the Node.js, like tooling committee, and even some of like the core, the technical steering committee folks. It was so cool for me to have the opportunity to just become a part of things bigger than me. Once I got things humming, like in that first year change that I was working on Lerna, it was actually a pretty cool buzz to be able to like release something and then be like, hey, look at that. I did a thing. And then people were like, yay. And that's a cool cycle.
This is something that I wanted to ask about, and I want to be very mindful of this question, and you can definitely feel free to decline. So most, if maintainers are fortunate, they never go through a big source of drama in their maintenance of a project. Yeah. You know, they hopefully it just is a thing that people install and forget about, and maybe makes a bug sometimes, and maybe you'll get someone who's cranky every now and again. But sometimes things happen and are, you know, very contentious moments come up. I don't really want us to talk about the sort of licensing issue that came up in detail. But I'm curious just to hear a little bit just from your perspective about like how you dealt with that, not from like an actual like how you responded, but like from a personal level. It's like how did you get through that, and like did you learn any lessons from that event that you can like share to people? And
And, you know, it's with the benefit of hindsight, it's been a few years now. I've been through therapy, which I sounds like I'm joking. I'm actually not. And I don't really want to, I'm sorry about joking about that, because it is pretty serious. Therapy for me has been a very, and not just for this most recent thing, over time, it's kind of like, I view it as a different form of exercise. You know, you work out, you build strength. This is just one way of doing it, but for your brain. Anyway, I just hope that's clear, because I think it's very important to, it sounds really wishy-washy, but get in touch with yourself to understand what you need. Like, you can't know what you need until you know yourself. You can't know yourself. And I'm saying, it's easier for someone who's, you know, a professional can help you get there much quicker. Not to say it's not impossible for individuals to find themselves on their own. It's just way quicker when you have someone to help you, who's, you know, trained and all those other good things. So that being said, one of the things, I mean, like I said, that event was the trigger for kind of like, that was really, it was a trigger. It was, I'm not sure if, I don't want to say that everyone should spend a day being the main character of Twitter, but because that would just be terrible and it would take a long time. But anyway, but in a similar vein, like when I was in my early 20s, I worked in retail, and I worked several Christmases in a row. And I always now feel from that experience, maybe everyone should work a retail Christmas just to get that experience, to give them a perspective on what it's like, you know? So I don't wish main character on Twitter on anybody, but the perspective it gave me, and this is speaking as a very privileged white heterosexual man, I did not experience let's just say my experience was very different than many other intersectional slices. Women, minorities, they have a much worse. Now, that being said, that sounds bad. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, and it's a similar reason that a solo maintainership isn't sustainable. When you're the main character on Twitter, you have no recourse. You have no way of explaining yourself that will actually improve things. Now, what does that mean? How can you deal with? I mean, I think it means mostly in the future when you see somebody going through that, you'll have a bit of empathy for them, regardless of the reason they're in that situation. You'll have some empathy no matter what. Now, the total amount of empathy will probably vary based on the context of how they became the main character. Certainly. I don't want to say that you have to give everyone a like get out of jail free card. But I would kind of hope that if there's anything you gain from my experience has in that relative to others, main characterhood, relatively minor experience, is that a small bit of empathy goes a long way. And But also, if you're ever in the situation, take it from me. Maybe it'll help, maybe it won't. But anything you try to explain while it's happening will be either ignored, misconstrued, or you'll react poorly. You'll react emotionally, which is like, I mean, duh, you're having this, you know, emotional existential crisis because the entire internet is falling on your head. And the only way you can react is emotionally. I still think about it to this day. Honestly, I don't fixate on it so much anymore, but I still think about it every now and again. It really changes you. And just like, I mean, to be honest, the maintaining a large project changes you. Adjusting to dealing with 50 or 100 different, you know, people's requests daily or whatever, that changes you in ways that are very noticeable. The tactical reality of being a main character on Twitter is that you kind of have to just let it work itself out. There's really nothing you can do until your life settles down, until your sensory inputs are back to close to baseline, because otherwise you're in this constant fight or flight mode and nothing good happens there. And it's at that point, I mean, the work's not done after things die down. I would say, you still have, in my case, I still had responsibilities to the community. I still had, I mean, I ultimately, you know, did that. I reconsidered, I reverted, I issued an apology. And like a real apology, saying like, I am sorry. And these are the steps I'm taking to, you know, to make better or make good. Because I think that's important. And it's like, even then, I'm pretty sure there's still people who think I'm terrible. And there's nothing you can do about that. You kind of have to just, if you're in any way significant, or like, if your profile has risen enough where people, you know, see you, or like, I don't know, I wouldn't say recognize on the street, but you know, that kind of like, oh gosh, he's the maintainer of Lerna. I mean, like, I'm like, yeah, you're going to have to deal with that. It's just kind of human nature. And burnout also, to tie back to burnout, also is in some ways, I read it somewhere on Twitter, the difference between your goals and what you're able to accomplish in whatever context you're in, like, and any number of things can prevent you from doing that, such as organizational imperatives or a bad boss, or just maybe being in the wrong job or the wrong whatever. And your body just kind of, you keep trying. I mean, everyone wants to do the best they can. If they're doing a job, but it's like, you can't, and that just digs at you like at a core level. So yeah. And that really, that kind of, so as I had this initial drop from that, licensing experience, my day job started to get more emphasis on, like, you know, product development. There was more pressure to do less work on Lerna. And initially it was that pressure wasn't from a negative place. It was somebody recognizing that work was very, emotionally damaging. I hesitate to say emotionally vampiric, you know, like it was draining. And they were trying to help me, you know, refocus on the stuff that I did have more control, you know, more potential to contribute to better. And I mean, so I understand that motivation. Unfortunately for me, that was only really, it wasn't addressing the deeper issues. It was just kind of, you know, treating the symptoms type thing. So my burnout did not improve. In a sense, it got worse because of that, because I felt more guilt, for not being able to contribute, as much as I wanted to. And then that guilt, it just compounds, right? I mean, it's like interest. It compounds. And you get to a place where it's so much guilt, it actually, not quite physically, but it feels certainly like a physical barrier to actually doing it, to writing anything, to addressing any issues. The one spurt of activity I had just over a year ago in January 2021, the only reason I had that was because the level of screeching from the audit warnings coincided with a short break between jobs where I had some headspace to like kind of fart around. And I think I mentioned at the time, I was just farting around with stuff. It, you know, gave me a little solace while I was dealing with some other stuff. But that wasn't like a recipe for actually surviving or for getting, you know, getting past the burnout. Cause that's just, it was just, again, mitigating the symptoms. It wasn't actually getting at the root causes. How do you spot burnout coming? I don't think you can. And that's kind of the, like, I wish you could, I really do. I think empathy is important for others and for yourself, because ultimately others can help, but you alone are the only one who can help you get out of or work through the burnout, like to not work through it, survive it. because more work rarely, in my experience, helps burnout. But there is, however, the potential of the right work helping. If you find yourself burnt out, if you find yourself there, you have to acknowledge it. You have to just be like, yeah, that's where I am. Finding things that you value, like things that you want to do, that also, I mean, has this fringe benefit of being, beneficial to society or beneficial to yourself or, you know, others that you love. That, I think, is one of the strongest ways to get to a place where you feel better. Because and maybe that is just, you know, taking some time out, having the extreme privilege of having these breaks out, you know, between jobs. It did help. And so then, as long as you've gotten yourself out of the negative environment that caused, or the negative patterns that caused burnout in the first place, then you just have to be patient, because to a certain degree, time is what heals burnout. And it doesn't have a schedule. You can try to graph it, but it would look pretty weird. It takes time, and you have to be patient with yourself. And certainly the last couple years in society at large has not helped anything in terms of getting over burnout. But leaving that whole thing aside, it takes time. And I think the general message is that you will get better eventually. And that is probably the best hope I can offer, is that we don't know a lot of things about burnout, actually. I think learning about others' experiences, listening to what they have to say, really helps. And exposing yourselves to other points of view, like points of view outside of your sphere, outside of however you identify, I think is also valuable, because it gives you just a much more richer tapestry of life. I mean, to kind of, not to compare yourself to others, but to just kind of gain new insights into, like, oh, that's what that is, or that sounds like that. And that kind of sympathy part, I don't know, words. But yeah, primarily empathy, patience, and time.
Yeah. So I went through a bout of burnout, 2020, 2021. And yeah, a lot of what you said resonates. I do think that like burnout can happen for a lot of different reasons. The way that I've sort of framed it to myself, it's like where your effort is misaligned with your emotion, or your emotion is misaligned with your effort. And a big event that like causes some sort of trauma. So like this license thing is definitely a point of trauma, something that causes trauma. And then you're sort of forced to go back and spend time there. Like, especially if you're doing something where you're like working, you know, you're working around your source of trauma is a like key, like, causation of burnout. You know, if it's something where you have to revisit that often and you don't have time to process it, then it can be rough. I will totally second your recommendation of finding a therapist is an excellent thing to do. Even if you're not burnout, you should probably find a therapist, because it's like, you know, these things definitely happen over time, and generally they happen in the most like, in the worst possible times, you know, in times of like high stress and you've got a lot of stuff going on in your life, and then suddenly you can't cope or function. So, you know, while you have the mental energy to form yourself a better baseline, it's best to go ahead and begin that journey. And take it from me, if you're feeling really burnout and life is hard and you just don't want to do anything or think about anything, the search for a therapist sucks. It is not fun.
Oh God. Yeah, no, it is.
So
yeah. I would say, when you're searching for a therapist, I would use every tool available to you. You know, like if your friends offer to do stuff for you, you say, yes, yes, please. And then lean on them as hard as you can. Because your close friends are doing it because they love you. And that's something that, you know, you might feel guilty about, but you shouldn't, because you need, the fact of the matter is, in most cases, when you're in that situation, you need help. And not just in the traditional way of, you know, you help. And it's like, yeah, parts, there are messages in our society that try to tell us, to convince us that we don't need help. And they're very strong. And it's just something, like, from my own experience of several people I've met, several friends, it's just like, it's necessary. And like you're saying, it getting a therapist is just, it helps not just when you're in the, you know, the bad times, but normal times too. Like having someone who can give you a structured insight into how your brain is working at any given time, super powerful. Helping you build those habits, building possible, like, habits. You can actually change your habits. Did you know that? It takes effort. It's hard. But having someone help guide you, having someone help give you these little tips and tricks that, like, are, you know, based in actual medical science, super helpful, it turns out. And so, just like, if you were to remodel your bathroom, for example, you would hire a contractor. Because, I mean, unless you're like Bob Vila or whatever, you probably don't have the skills to do the whole thing yourself. And even if you did, you can't do it by yourself, because there are things like toilets and bathtubs that are really heavy. So anyway, what I'm getting at is, you shouldn't feel any more stigma about getting a therapist than you would hiring a contractor. I mean, like, we do that all the time. We hire contractors all the time. We don't feel bad about it. We hire plumbers all the time. They're great. Plumbers are awesome. I love plumbers. They do important jobs. And so do therapists. Therapists do important jobs too. And that is one of my other messages, is we should hire more therapists to plumb our depths.
Nice.
I connected them.
One important lesson from my journey that I definitely would share, that I try to share with everybody, is just as important as it is to find a therapist, that is a relationship that you are very vulnerable in. if that therapist is not right for you, find a different therapist. Because just like a great therapist can help you tremendously, a bad therapist can harm you greatly. If we're going to go to the contractor example, great contractor can build you a beautiful bathroom, and a bad contractor can leave you with problems that you have to work around for years. So
it can leave you with a poop geyser.
Yeah. For sure. Definitely take the time to find somebody who works for you.
Right. We should put a bingo card right in the middle is poop geyser. that's totally true. I think I kind of consider that part of the whole process, the really terrible, long, painful process of finding a therapist is part of that, you know, are they right for you type thing. It's like you can probably find someone to talk to in that guise relatively easy, but is it the right person for you? Does it lead in the right direction? That's the real trick. And that's the thing that takes time. Totally agree. You have to have the right therapist as well. Not just anyone. It's certainly not helped by our whole medical system, being what it is, definitely makes everything 10 times harder than it should be, but we somehow muddle through.
So we've looked to the past mainly in this episode, but let's look to the future a little bit. So for a while there, it looked like Lerna itself was going to just kind of die. Nobody was going to maintain it. It seemed like you had an initial hesitance to like passing on stewardship of the project to somebody. But recently, I think yesterday, you announced that Narwhal would be taking over the reins and helming the project. So why were you initially hesitant to hand over those reins, and what about Narwhal changed that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was initially hesitant for, any number of supply chain attacks over the past few years in the NPM ecosystem. Long-suffering maintainers, very smart people, get social engineered into handing over the credentials to a Bitcoin miner or whatever. And I definitely, I didn't want that to happen to me. So I get really paranoid about that. And on the other hand, and also, so I guess I can take a step back and say, one of my failings as a maintainer of Lerna was that I did not cultivate outside contributors enough. I didn't build a team. I was a solo maintainer for years. I should not have been, in retrospect. But that's what happens. If I would do it all over again, I would spend a lot more energy at making it not a one-man shop, but being part of a team, so that we could share the burden. Now, one of the reasons you do that, I know now, is that you don't have to worry so much about finding a survivor, so to speak, or passing on the project to another steward happens less when you have a larger team. But that being said, I mean, there's the old XKCD comic of the one programmer in Nebraska who maintains this tiny little library that the entire internet is built on. It resonated a lot with me. not to say that I'm anywhere near that level of built on the internet on me, but that style of what if I mess up? What if I pick the wrong person? What if I doom the project by doing that? But it's the cost of inaction is almost the same. It's like I would doom the project. I would make it slowly die. And it's quite a pickle to be in, I gotta say. Not remotely on any comparison to many other forms and sources of trauma, but in the context of open source maintainership, it is probably one of the higher or bigger sources of stress for most solo or small group maintainers is that succession plan. What happens when you move on? What happens when you can't do it anymore? I mean, like, any number of reasons. I was really glad that Narwhal reached out to me a couple weeks ago. Because I was already kind of tangentially familiar with Narwhal. They wrote there's a website called monorepo.tools, which I think is just an excellent, excellent resource describing what monorepos are, how they work, what, you know, like even down to like the nitty gritty of the decision making process, like what kind of monorepo do you want? And I mean, yeah, they talk about NX. Why wouldn't they? NX is a great tool. They even have comparisons between like a lot of different things, like, you know, that was really cool. And so already I had a pretty high estimation of them as, you know, as open source contributors. I got to talk with Jeff Cross, and just like I got a really great insight into the company itself, which is like, you know, very, you know, devoted to open source. Like they make money because they're a company. That's the whole point. But alongside that, they are super great about nurturing community in open source. They do a good job of publishing roadmaps and soliciting feedback and like all the things that I felt guilty about not doing. There they were doing it and, you know, making a sustainable business out of it. Really resonated with me because I think that last part of the sentence, making a sustainable business out of it, is really important. Because it's open source, really, sustainability wise, is very difficult. It's not impossible, but it is very difficult outside of a more like traditional corporate sponsorship model. And a corporate sponsorship doesn't mean literally like, you know, decals on your hood like NASCAR. But like, I mean, for example, when I was working on Lerna almost full time, Zillow was the sponsor of Lerna. I mean, it was implicit at the time, but that's kind of the reality. I've noticed most, and I will say Babbel being one of the exceptions. Babbel is like super popular and super successful, largely, I mean, due to community efforts, but I think a lot of it rests on Henry Zhu's shoulders. Henry is just an amazing example of a maintainer. If more people learned about him and try and emulated him, I think we'd be better off as a culture. But you know, not everyone can be Babbel. It's just, you know, not everyone can be React and Facebook, or you know, not everyone has Google or Amazon behind them. So to find an entity like Narwhal, the individuals that are made up, you know, Jeff and Yuri and many others that I haven't met yet. That was such a strong signal to me that I felt really comfortable handing over the you know, various, you know, ownerships and tokens and whatever. Just because I felt that they had really good alignment with the goals of Lerna. Like their corporate, or, you know, their company goals were aligned with the goals of Lerna. And, you know, they'll probably add a couple pointers to NX in various appropriate places in the docs. I think that's great because the more people are exposed to more different solutions, I think the better choices we can all make. It was certainly not, you know, if you were comparing Lerna for any number of reasons, like Lerna Bootstrap, it can't hold a candle to Yarn or NPM's works or PNPM's workspaces. I mean, like those are super great and fast and robust, and they're all like in the lock file natively now. And yeah, nobody should be using Lerna Bootstrap today. Just put it out there. You really, unless you are stuck in 2017 land for some weird reason, you shouldn't be using Lerna Bootstrap because things are so much better now. And yeah, but that was really for it for me, was that first of all, I mean, it was a company, it was a healthy company. they had a strong ethos of, you know, open source participation, open source leadership. I felt that, and the missions really aligned. So that kind of, that was my thought process there. I couldn't have really chosen a better partner, really. I mean, I want to just speak one moment to the, all the people who did reach out with offers of maintainership. I really appreciate them. And I don't want to make it sound like I think you were some weirdo who was going to inject Bitcoin miner, but also it was, I hope you understand the amount of pressure I was putting myself under. The fear that I had of being like another headline was so great that I think it really, it took a really ideal situation like Narwhal to kind of break through that, honestly. And so everyone who did offer, I again really appreciate, and I think it speaks very highly of people's motivations that they were willing to volunteer. I really do appreciate that, and I think there are several other projects I'm sure that everyone uses every day that could benefit from more participation, and even learn. I mean, if you want to, like, there's nothing. I'm pretty certain that Narwhal is going to facilitate, community involvement on an ongoing basis. I mean, like, getting involved in the issues, getting involved in discussions, contributing stuff. You know, like, interacting or like giving feedback on their roadmap that they're going to drop soon. I mean, like, that would be super helpful to have just like more voices that they can integrate into that product vision. I think will just benefit everyone long term. Because it's hard to do. It's hard to do. And having more people with they have a very complementary skill set. Like, they've got the architect side, they've got the tool builders, but they've also got the DevRel folks, and they've got the all the tools that I never had. And I was so glad that a company like Narwhal exists and is able to both benefit the community and benefit themselves. I mean, that's the win-win ideal in my mind.
So one last quick question before we get on to tool tips. Do you plan on publishing more packages? Are you going to make more tools, or has this experience made you very hesitant to put new things out there?
I certainly don't expect to become the lead maintainer of a project the size of Lerna again. And mostly because I think if I ever get involved with a project anywhere approaching that size in the future, I'm going to have all these lessons that I learned previously to, you know, help kind of avert that the ending, or at least the bad parts of the ending. Anyway, it wouldn't just be me, so it would be a different experience entirely. But in the larger sense, I expect to publish more things. How broadly useful they'll be, it's up for debate. Early last year, I was all about like, oh yeah, I want to write or extract a versioning and publishing only tool. And I got a little bit into it and just like, this, the state of ES modules really parches my mellow right now. I also started an actual day job shortly after that. So I ran out of steam, but in my day to day, as a front end developer, I fully expect to keep contributing patches and stuff and even features to open source libraries. I mean, it's just kind of, what I've come to expect is like being a good citizen of open source means you contribute, you pitch in where you're able. Sometimes that's patches, sometimes it's just tickets, sometimes it's just testing. I mean, running a beta or whatever, and saying if it's thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever. That really does help. So I won't really ever completely extract myself from open source. I will be a bit more cognizant of the balance. Like I'll be a little. I mean, also, I'll be forced to be that, you know, as a parent, and you know, there's other parts of my life now that that definitely influence the choices that I make in that department. But as much as I'm able, I do plan on being you know, as much as contributing to open source as for the foreseeable future. I mean, as long as they'll have me, I guess, you know. but yeah, that's pretty much my plan.
Awesome. Well, with that, I think we should move on to tooltips. Okay, so my first tooltip is from a developer named Eric Clemens. He currently works at Stripe and has produced a lot of tiny little useful tools, one of them even inspiring Otto to a certain degree. This one I was playing around with last night, and it is a really cool way of opening up components in your editor. So all you have to do is add a component at the root level of your project. And then if your project is using the Babel React preset, it all works already. And then you can hold option over any component and just click on it, and it'll open right in your editor. And then you can right click and see all of the components that led up to that component. So say you have a design system you use a lot. Instead of opening the button, you probably want to open the place that uses the button. So you right click instead, and then you can see all of the tree leading up to that. It was a little hard to set up in our repo, but I'm already loving it a lot. It is way better than me opening up the dev tools, trying to either figure out by class names what the component is, or by using the React dev tools. Like, React dev tools are great, but when you start having like context and high order components, that tree gets messy as hell, and it's hard to actually connect component to file, and this just makes that interaction instant. So it's pretty new. It only works with VS Code currently, but there's PRs for it to work on other editors. So if you're looking for something like this, I'd highly recommend to try it out. Now we have Bat.
Oh yeah. Yes, this is Bat. I have this, I guess, habit, you might say, of using the shell a lot. For front end dev, it's suspiciously a lot, but I can't get over it. Really, it's super helpful. Now, Bat specifically is like cat, but with wings. Anytime you want to like look at a file locally, and you just don't want to bother opening up in your editor or whatever, you just want to look at it. And Bat has got so many neat bells and whistles. Chiefly, it's the syntax highlighting, it's the line numbers, and just ways of making. You wouldn't think cat it needs much more, but it's just cool how it integrates. It's written in Rust. It's available through Homebrew. I've found it to be really handy. The other one I was want to talk about was FD, which is similarly it's a Rust built CLI tool that is a replacement for find. And the cool thing is that like there's a little demo there, but like FD has great defaults. FD integrates with like all the shell coloring you might ever want. It has really useful and descriptive flags in a way that find, for all of its usefulness, I have never found an incantation of find to be particularly like readable or
intuitive.
I can't do intuitive. Yeah. Like I can't do it from memory. I have to look it up every single time with find. FD like gets out of the way, and you find yourself just like, even just typing FD and hitting enter, it'll give you a listing of whatever, you know, wherever you are. Like, and it's just, I don't know. I find, as someone who spends a lot of time in the terminal, tools like this really help, you know, like piping especially. Oh man, it's like I can get a list of files that I want with, you know, it, ways that are just so much easier than mucking around with find. And yeah, it's just one of the tools I use pretty much daily. Similarly, I didn't list anything but like ripgrep. I would be remiss if I didn't. It's often goes by RG, but yeah, ripgrep is another Rust-based replacement for grep, similar to like Silver Surfer and which is AG, and then there's ACK, of course. ACK is cool, but RipGrep is like ACK on steroids. And it's super fast, optimized for surfing code, and in a similar way, similar vein to like FD versus is defined as RipGrep is to, well, grep basically. It makes like the flags are a little more intuitive. The pattern support is better. The output is just much more useful. I use RipGrep every like hourly, easily. I mean, I it's just something I'm constantly getting or reaching for creating various pipes of like look for all the files that have import React in them or whatever, you know, like various things like that. And it's super like it automatically filters out node modules and any number of other things like that. So it's super useful. Those are my tips.
I've really enjoyed the whole wave of like Rust rewrites of like old tools.
Yeah.
I mean, because so many of them are just like excellent, excellent.
Well, it like harkens back to what we were saying earlier in the conversation and make your tool tiny, focused on one thing, doing it really well. The tools these are replacing are tools that did one thing well for 30, 40 years. They did it really well. And like only now do we have like a language that makes it, we can make it really fast and all these bells and whistles that we now come to expect. But yeah.
Yeah, I think our expectations have just shifted over time, and because those tools worked so well for so long, people didn't like want to introduce something new. But like, what do we expect to see? What do we expect to have? You know, it's like things like, oh, you know, I want line numbers, or I want syntax highlighting, or you know, these things that we kind of take for granted in a lot of experiences are being added now.
Yeah, well, even DX has come a long way. Yeah, like, exactly. We expect our interfaces to be a lot simpler and easier to understand, whereas back in the day, they were like, yeah, we were coding in assembly, so these flags are fine.
Yeah, right.
And I'm sure there's a lot of like common shortcuts and stuff that are just not socialized in the same way anymore, so they don't make as much sense in context now as they did once, you know, if you were really steeped in the
Unix ecosystem. Sure.
Cool. So the first thing that I want to share today is this really, really interesting project that I stumbled upon on Twitter. It's called Astro Service Worker. And essentially what this does is brings server-side rendering, SSR, for Astro in a service worker. I have thought about this approach a lot. It's like, can you get server-side rendering, you know, and just do that at the browser level? And like, what would that look like? And this project is a proof of concept of that. So yeah, it does server-side rendering for Astro in the browser, in a service worker. Maybe this is something that you could eventually like push off. You know, your first request is just, you know, a normal request, and then like subsequent like page renders or whatever coming from the service worker, or maybe you do it all. I don't know. It's just an experiment. It's really, really interesting. Not sure what the actual performance characteristics of this really would be, but it's kind of a neat project. So if you just like to geek out about stuff like this, like I do, something to check out.
Looks cool.
Talking about Rust, like crazy Rust projects. So I stumbled across this project. It's called Space Drive. It is a file explorer that is cross-platform, written in Rust. Actually, it uses this framework called Tari, which is a Electron alternative that uses Rust and then whatever the built-in like web view is for the OS that you're on. But so Space Drive, this app, is fascinating because they implement a virtual hard drive. So you can technically have this file explorer show you files from like multiple computers or from like your computer and from, I don't know, a cloud service or whatever. And you can sort of browse all the files like they were on your local hard drive. This is really, really interesting to me for multiple reasons. I think a lot of our modern WoW explorers are generally not great. If you think Finder on OS X,
which I've used
OS X for years, and Finder, I still like get so frustrated with it. And then,
yeah.
I mean, Explorer on Windows, it's fine, and that's the best thing I can say. So, I'm super excited about this, and it's a really cool usage of the Toria technology. It's awesome, yeah, cool project, A+. And the design of the marketing site is also A+. I love everything about it. So good.
I like the index size, not a number.
Oh yeah. Okay. I looked at this website and saw Tailwind, and I was not incorrect. Okay, that wraps it up for tooltips. Thanks, Daniel, for coming on. This was a much different episode than we usually have, but I think it was a good episode to have and an important topic to talk about.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of DevTools FM. Be sure to follow us on YouTube and wherever you consume your podcasts. Thanks for listening.